Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of August. Just returned from 2 weeks in Ireland and happy to be with you again. Thanks to Veronica Rickard and others who filled in for me while I went to the country, which is incredibly expensive these days, but absolutely beautiful and filled with people who love to talk about politics and many other issues. In just a few moments, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, will be joining us. She has a new book, and it is titled Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. She became Speaker of the House in 2007 and, of course, made history by doing so. She served 20 years in Congress. She is the mother of 5 children and the grandmother of 7. And she covers a lot of territory in the book. She, of course, talks about the war in Iraq. She talks about health care, about AIDS, which was the issue that got her to Congress really in the first place. She talks about her disagreements with the president. She discusses health care in great detail and also talks quite a bit about her children, about the roads that they took, her family. Her father was a very high political guy in Baltimore and also was a member of the House. So she talks about how she was raised and how she entered politics. And of course, the question that she has asked over and over is, how did you raise 5 children and go to Congress? And she talks about that and also about how she's in awe of the young women who come to Congress while they're still having children and raising small children. She discusses child care and how we need affordable and good child care in this country and many more issues. And she'll be joining us momentarily. She isn't with us for the full hour today. David Winston will also be joining us. David is the president of the Winston Group. He was formerly the director of planning for the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, where he oversaw initiatives ranging from education, taxes, social security, health care, and technology. And he also was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He'll be joining us the second part of this hour for our All Things Political, which we do every Monday here on the Ideas Network. We'll be taking a few phone calls for Madam Speaker, and let me give you our phone number for the entire 2 hours. This is how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And we'll have time for a couple of calls for Nancy Pelosi and many calls for David Winston, and you can help me fill me in about what's been going on politically. It's amazing how little news there was, and there were places where I couldn't get the news in Ireland, but how little news there was of what was going on in America with a political campaign. Ireland, of course, as much of Europe is, it has been having great boom times for the past 10 years, but the headlines of their newspapers as we were leaving the country talk about growth forecast going downward, household net wealth fallen by a great deal in that country, and who knows what the scene will be a year from now or even 6 months from now. So you can fill me in on all the details of the political race, which I just, you know, couldn't keep up with. We didn't have a computer. We read the newspapers, but the stories weren't covered as much as they are, of course, here in the United States. So you can fill me in on details as we cover all things political. Second hour of our show today, it will be an open line. It's August, and we always do one open line, so we thought we would ease into a new week and a new month and ask for you to give us your contributions of programs that you would like to have. So all of that's coming up this hour. And we're pleased to welcome the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who will be with us shortly. Nancy Pelosi joining us. She has a new book, Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. And it's just filled with all kinds of information about what she is doing politically, what her concerns are, and also fascinating information about how she was raised in a very political family. Many members of her family, her brothers, she has a number of brothers, have also entered the political world. She'll have a lot to say, I'm sure, about the current campaign and about the president in the last 8 years. She, of course, has not been extremely happy about the course of the country the past 8 years. And we'll have time for a couple phone calls for her as well. So get your thoughts together about what you would like to ask, and we'll be with you on the air momentarily. Our number again is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. She, as you know, the House is in recess, and she is with us right now. Madam Speaker, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Yeah, delighted to have you on the air with us.
Thank you.
Let's start with Iraq, if you don't mind. Part of the book talks about the problems that you've had with the last 8 years, and you also are very concerned about health care. 40 days in Iraq, you say, could pay for 10 million American children to be insured for 1 year, so why don't we do that?
Because President Bush says we can't afford to insure those children, and that's why we make the point we can't afford to insure our children. 10 million children for 1 year for 40 days in Iraq. It's just the wrong priorities. And this war has had other opportunity costs for us in terms of investments in America as well. But the war is the big issue, and we had hoped that we could work with the president to take the country in a new direction in terms of that war in Iraq, but we weren't able to do so. In the House, we passed the bill over and over again, sent it over to the Senate where it would die because it requires 60 votes and the Republicans would just not go along with a redeployment of our troops safely, honorably, responsibly, and soon. But when we have a new president, we have taken the first steps. When we have a new president, we'll be on that track. And then we can attend to the challenges we have at home to make the investments in our infrastructure, to create good-paying jobs here in America, to invest in the new technologies to make us energy independent, to reverse global warming, to educate our children, that all of America's children have those opportunities, and to build our military in a way that enables us to meet the challenges to our security wherever they may occur.
Mm-hmm.
I talk in the book about my disappointment in being able to have the president at least respect the wishes of the voters in last year's election in that regard.
And tell me, what kind of statement do you think, Madam Speaker, the voters were making? It was a big election. What were we all saying to you?
Well, I think the election 06 was step one, and the message was we need change. We need to go in a new direction.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, we have made many changes in terms of the minimum wage and college affordability and pay equity and toy safety and honoring our veterans, and the list goes on. But it's all eclipsed by the fact that the war is still going on. Because, as I said, American people want results. They don't want to hear about process. So we're ready. Now, this step two will come in 08. We'll strengthen our and grow our majority in the Congress, in the House for sure, and the Senate, where we need to, so that we don't have the obstructionism. And I'm certain with a Democratic president, we can go in a new direction. And that new direction talks about putting people first. This is about the people's interest, not the special interest.
Let's talk about your family some. I'll ask you this question. I know you must be asked this more than any other question, but it is amazing. Here you are, Speaker of the House. You raised five children.
Right.
You have a number of grandchildren, and you put your family first. You're able to do that. I think it's a logical question for me to ask. How in the world could you have done that in your life? It's so much.
That's the question I got asked over and over again, so that's why I wrote the book. And actually, I wrote it last year about 5 days with my children. My husband were talking into the recorder to get it all down, and then we spent another 5 days here and there to get the rest of the story, Baltimore, New York, Washington, and San Francisco. And it turned out to be 1,100 pages long, and I thought, no, this is too long. So we shortened the book to increase the impact of how this happened. And it is quite remarkable to go from housewife to House Speaker, from
the
kitchen to the Congress. And that's the message I want people to understand. If I can do this, they can do anything,
mm-hmm.
anything they set out to do, to know the strengths that they have within them, and that raising a family forges you. It forges you in such a way in terms of your priorities, in terms of your intuitive thinking, in terms of your sense of organization and discipline, in terms of common sense and getting a job done. So the women go to the table. They bring this experience of millions of women in America to that table to create policy that is better for America's families. Mm-hmm. And also for the national security of our country, the strength of our economy, the energy independence, you know, all of the other issues as well, but from a perspective of, is this relevant to the lives of the American people?
You cite, Madam Speaker, the Jerry Brown campaign as being pivotal in your movement in politics, in your role in politics. Why was that so pivotal?
It was a funny thing because I'm Harriet housewife at home to take care of my kids, and I see that Jerry Brown wanted to run for president. He was the governor of California at the time, and then I also saw that in Maryland they said that if you're a recognized candidate any other place in America, that you will be placed on the ballot in Maryland. So I called my friend Leo McCarthy, who was the campaign chairman, and said, we have to go to Maryland because California is too late. By California, we'll already have a nominee. So so we went to Maryland. We had four-week campaign, 3 weeks, 1 week to organize, 3 weeks to run the campaign, and we won. Now, we didn't win delegates because we were too late for delegates, but we won the popular vote, which was extraordinary. Nobody had even heard of, many people had not heard of him before then. But in any event, he drew big crowds, and, as his reputation grew, we won the election. So when we went back to and this is all in Know Your Power in the book. When we went back to California, the first welcoming back, Jerry Brown stands up in front of this cheering, surprised throng of thousands of people and says, Nancy Pelosi was the architect of my Maryland campaign, which I was. Mm-hmm. But he admitted it, and, I mean, he recognized it, and that was step one out of the kitchen, because then I became a delegate to the convention for him and a member of the Democratic National Committee, and then that led to my becoming chair of the Democratic Party. But just that one thing, but I was ready. I didn't have ambition for it. I didn't seek it, but when it came, I recognized it and I was ready.
So that
was a big transition,
right.
And that's what I say to women: see the opportunity. Now, sometimes you're not ready, so don't go. I've done that too.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, take advantage of the opportunities, win or lose, have an impact on how you go.
Right.
Learn from it.
Right. Let's take at least one call. I promise our audience.
Okay.
Yeah. Jim from Salt Lake City is calling. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen.
Morning, Jim.
Morning, Madam Speaker. Hey, I want you to know, I think you've been one of our better speakers in United States history. But
right.
I have one concern. It seems as though there hasn't been much opposition or choice for the American people. It seems like a lot of the things that the president has wanted, for whatever reason, the Democrats in the House have gone along with it, such as the wiretapping and now this offshore drilling. And I guess I'm beginning to feel that there's really no choice between the Democrats and the Republicans. You've kind of merged together. I don't know if it's special interest or what. But I'm really discouraged that when we go into the booth, are we really picking the best of two people, or are we just picking the more popular name?
Madam Speaker.
Well, I appreciate your question, but I don't completely agree with the premise of it. I have been fighting this offshore drilling in protected areas. It is a wrong thing to do. It is a hoax on the American people that it's going to bring down prices. It will not. We have a counterproposal, which is free our oil from the stockpile, and it will in 10 days bring down the price of the oil. This price of oil won't come down for 10 years with this drilling, and only 2 cents in 10 years. So I completely agree with you, but the Democrats in the Congress have been fighting that, and we've been fighting it to the point that the Republicans now are, Friday they wouldn't give up, leave the floor, and today they're supposedly going back. And what I call that is the war dance of the handmaidens of the oil industry, because this is, we have two paths here. We can more of the same, which brought us to $4 a gallon gas, or a new path, which invest in renewables, recognizing the role natural gas will play, end the excessive speculation, use it or lose it, drill where we can. Have permits, not go where it's fragile to drill there. So we have made a big distinction between Democrats and Republicans on the subject. And by the way, some Republicans agree with us. The the president does not. The president wants to give subsidies to big oil instead of and at a time when they have record profits, instead of having that be invested in renewable energy resources and with tax credits and research. So on that point, on the FISA, I share your concern. But again, we had a good bill, went to the Senate, couldn't get 60 votes. So the compromise bill is one that I don't love, but that is infinitely better than what would have been if. And by the way, in the Senate, the Democrats were complicit on the FISA bill. It was unfortunate, or else they wouldn't have gotten 60 votes for their proposal. But that's the bill that we ended up with. But, you know, we'll have a new president pretty soon, and it's a question of how this is implemented. And I know this issue backward, forward, and sideways, and the improvements we made in the House on this bill were very important to the Constitution. And that's why I'm glad we got some support from some people who have been stalwart supporters of the Constitution, recognizing this was the best we could do, far better than what the Senate was proposing to us. So that's why we have to have more Democrats elected, more Democrats in the House, more in the Senate, but most important to elect a Democratic president of the United States. Nothing less is at stake than our economy, our energy situation, the housing market, the Constitution, our reputation overseas. We must end that war and bring our troops safely and soon. And our Democrats voted overwhelmingly every time to send to the Senate legislation to redeploy our troops. The Senate just couldn't get the 60 votes. So, I appreciate your frustration with it, but stick with me on this fight. Oh, sure, because it is, if they're telling the American people that if you drill in these protected areas, it's going to bring down the price at the pump, that's a complete hoax. But that's what they're telling them. So you see all the polls say American people support drilling. And then the tagline is because it will bring down price at the pump, which it will not. So this is the big fight. This is the big fight. We'll either have a path to the future with new green economy and reducing our dependence on foreign oil and fossil fuels, or we will have the same old, same old. And that's what elections are about.
Thanks, Jim. It's an important time in American history, isn't it, Madam Speaker?
Yes, it is. It's a very crucial time, and the opportunities that technology and science give us are just great for us to be number one in the economy, to invest in our infrastructure and energy and the rest, and health care for all Americans. And we just have to win to do that, because these values evidently are not shared by the Republicans, if I may have a moment of partisanship. But if you read my book, you'll see why I am this way and how a woman got to break the marble ceiling.
Yes, you will.
Thank you so much, Madam Speaker,
Thank
for being
you,
with
Emily,
us. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House. The book is Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. It has just been published. The House, of course, in recess. She put it in recess last Friday, and she's doing a couple interviews, and we're happy to have her with her for some of all things political. We'll carry on with our discussion, as we always do, politics on Mondays. David Winston will be joining us momentarily. He's president of the Winston Group, and he was formerly the director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, where he oversaw initiatives ranging from education, taxes, Social Security, healthcare, and technology to the 21st Century Congress. He was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he did statistical policy, and he also served in a senior staff role to four RNC chairmen. He'll be with us in a moment. And we'll take your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And David Winston is joining us now for the rest of the hour for all things political, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Hello, David. How are you?
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay. Doing well.
Good.
Congratulations. Nice coup.
What's that?
Getting the speaker on.
Not a bad booking, right?
Yeah, no. Again, having worked for the speaker, I know how hard that is to get them scheduled, and so well done.
Yeah, thanks very much. Well, you have to fill me in on political news. I've been in Ireland for the last 2 weeks, and I don't have a clue what's going on other than, you know, trying to catch up yesterday. But let's start with this offshore oil drilling, which the speaker brought up and which certainly has become a part of the campaign here, David. From what I've heard over the weekend, 60% of the American public are in favor of that. Can you take on that issue and where Democrats are, where McCain is, where Obama is on this issue, where we are, and if we need to do it in order to bring down the price of gas?
Well, it's clearly an issue that has changed the sort of dynamic and context of the election. Looking at where things were back last spring, it looked like it was going to be the war in Iraq and then the overall economy, nothing sort of really specific beyond just sort of general cost of living. And then we got hit with $4 a gallon gas prices. And, mm-hmm. and over time, people have been thinking, was it $2.50 or $3? What would be the sort of breaking point? And apparently $4 was it. And what you've seen now as a result is that given cost of living problems that people were dealing with, the $4 gallon just completely sort of overwhelmed them. And what you're seeing from the public is do everything, do anything, just do something. And what's happened is that you've seen support for drilling jump, by significant margins. You typically seen in polls it be sort of barely ahead at about 50%. But now you've seen polls by Gallup, CNN, where that number is now approaching 70%.
Right.
And part of that is what people are looking for, or at least this is what the surveys seem to imply, is we want the most amount of drilling, we want the most amount of alternative energy, we want the most amount of conservation, the most amount of nuclear. Where people are is everything, mm-hmm. and the most of it. What Speaker Pelosi is facing in the House is particularly complicated because basically she doesn't want a vote to come to the floor on drilling because it's pretty clear that she would lose that vote by probably a pretty decent margin, because what you're seeing is a lot of those new Democrats who came from some more conservative areas of the country, rural North Carolina, for example, mm-hmm. That at this point there are a lot of Democrats that she's got who would quickly vote for additional drilling. And so she's trying to manage a situation where personally she's opposed to it, but if she actually let it come to the floor, it would probably pass by a pretty decent margin. And so that's the dynamic she's dealing with. And as you could tell, she's feeling a little bit of pressure about
right.
that.
Right. And what about the alternative energy that you have mentioned and others have mentioned? Why is it that we're not moving more in that direction? Because no matter how much oil is from offshore drilling, eventually it's going to be gone, right? We do need to move somewhere else. And I think that's pretty much a bipartisan viewpoint on this.
Yeah, when you, again, that's not merely just bipartisan, it's where American people are. Mm-hmm. Long term, people understand that ultimately we're going to have to move to alternative energy. The dynamic that they're facing is, but what do you do now? It's not like you can suddenly have a different car tomorrow. And a lot of people are feeling that personally. There are a lot of people who have high gas mileage cars who would, in fact, like to be able to buy, low mileage gas cars in terms of not getting very many miles to the gallon, who would like to buy a car that gets better gas mileage and they can't get out of the car that they're in.
Right.
Right. And so it's the transition process that is clearly what people are focused on. So kind of where people are, they realize for the short run, and they understand that it's a short-run solution, short-run in this case being 10, 15 years, that it is likely to be oil-based, but that longer-term, 25 years, that ultimately we're going to have to move toward alternative energy. And so that's why they have this approach of do as much as you can, just all of it. And you're going to see some political pressure. Obama's going to do a statement today on energy, and what you're likely to see is him move to accepting some level of additional drilling as a result of sort of the political pressure here,
mm-hmm.
which he sort of telegraphed on Friday, but we'll see what it actually.
Which makes his base pretty angry, David, would you say?
I think there are two bases. Okay, base number one, the sort of small 8 to 10% of the Democratic Party that are true hardcore activists. Yes, the broader base in terms of the people you'd expect to turn out and vote just normally as Democrats, the sort of 20%, not so much because they're dealing with that cost of living and gas prices are really high, and they'd like to see that happen as well in terms of just, and it's not so much they're for drilling, they're for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a distinction that Pelosi's having some difficulty in managing, and you're watching Obama adjust to. And for Republicans, this also gave us the sort of needed change in topic, which has certainly made things a little bit more complicated in terms of politics at this point.
Right. What did you make of her comments about Iraq?
A variety of different things. One of the things that you're, and this is sort of an important debate that occurred in 2004 that you're seeing you'll see occur in 2008, and that is, so how important was Iraq to the national security of this country, or was it a war of choice? How connected is it mm-hmm. to the war on terror? Kerry did that in sort of an inarticulate way, just simply saying, we need to get out of there because the war wasn't working. And at that point, things were a lot more complicated than they were now in terms of the surge seeming to have some good local success within Iraq. What you're seeing happen this time around in terms of where the debate is, where the Democrats are trying to frame this, is that if we're going to be successful in the war on terror, we need to focus on Afghanistan, and the war in Iraq is not where this is going to be. And so that's where you see sort of the distinction in terms of the two parties, Republicans still saying the war in Iraq is central in terms of the war on terror, and you see Democrats saying what we'd like to do is focus in on Afghanistan. And what she's focused in on is the cost of Iraq in terms of the things that we weren't able to do, which is correct, but again, the idea of what's the value of national security. And so that's the debate that she's obviously trying to set it up as domestic versus national security, where Republicans are saying, well, we need to do that because we have to protect everybody first.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. We have a number of people who want to join our All Things Political conversation. David Winston with us this part of the program, and he did hear the conversation with Nancy Pelosi. So some of our comments are taken from what she had to say about certain issues, health care, Iraq, energy. Let's go to Dick from Sister Bay for our first caller, David. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Kathleen. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm delighted you have a Republican strategist on as a counterpoint. I understand that Mr. Winston was part of the Gingrich House regime during the late 90s, so he's quite familiar with impeachment. And as we all know, Mr. Clinton was impeached for lying under oath. Going back and looking at what the House Judiciary Committee said during that time, they made very potent statements about the importance of impeachment to protect Congress. And now we have Mr. Bush, who has admitted approving enhanced interrogation, which the Red Cross calls torture. And we have him admitting that he abridged wiretapping laws. And we all know that he conflated 9/11 with Saddam Hussein, thereby helping Americans understand why we had to go to Iraq. So I'm wondering how the Republican strategist thinks about the relationship we have between the presidency and the Congress, and what's our future here with a Democratic Party that has no interest at all in impeaching a runaway presidency? That's the question.
Okay. Thanks for the call, David.
Actually, it's a really interesting and complicated question, because the relationship between Congress and the president over an extended period of time here has been not good. Perhaps unlike other Republicans, I thought the Clinton impeachment was, I understand the logic that some had in terms of pursuing it, but I thought that it ended up distracting from what the country needed at that point in time, although there are clearly a lot of Republicans who felt very committed to it. But I think it also led to what Dick was describing, and that is we've now had this relationship between the House and Congress where it's just hugely combative. And what you've seen as an extension of that is policy then becomes impeachable offenses. And the thing is, or perceived impeachable offenses. And the dynamic here is, look, you can have honest policy differences without sort of impugning motives. And what you've seen is motives have been impugned, and there's just this huge level of frustration. It's one of the things I think that America is frustrated with, this sort of hyper-partisanship. And one of the things I think they're looking forward to in terms of whoever the next president is that somehow that'll be ratcheted down considerably, because the frustration from the public is very high with that.
And thanks very much for the call. Doris Kearns Goodwin, I'm sure you saw this in the Times yesterday, had an interesting piece taken off from Lincoln, who put some of his enemies or those opposed to his policies in his cabinet. Do you think that if we had a McCain or Obama presidency, they would be entertaining the same idea?
A little more. Right? How so? What do you?
That either of them would put her point being that both McCain and Obama might be willing to put in their cabinet, in their administration, some people who had spoken out against them, or maybe people from another party.
My sense is I'm not quite sure in terms of people had spoken out against them, but I think what you're going to see both these folks, you're watching them in terms of the general election, is that they want to be more inclusive, that they want to get a sense of a broader cross-section of a broader majority within the cabinet. Here's an interesting difference between 2004 and 2008. 2004, basically both candidates were trying to get to 51%. Right? They were just simply trying to win, and so we were watching those last few states in terms of what was going to happen. There was not this attempt to really sort of build this broader coalition, which you really need to govern. These two, McCain and Obama, are both trying to expand the universe in terms of who will vote for them. I mean, they're both going after 60%, 65% of the country in the hope that they can win by a decent margin or that they'll have a broad enough coalition that they can actually govern. And that is a very different approach. So I think in terms of just the way they're approaching the political discourse, they've changed the nature of it. Now the question is, as we get closer to the election, do people tend to focus in? And there's where you're beginning to see all the negativity and negative attacks as you decide that winning is more important than trying to put together a governing majority. That's the struggle you're going to watch in terms of both these campaigns. Mm. Ultimately, I think both of them would like to go to that broader concept that she was laying out. The question is, can they get there?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Marion from Richland Center. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I think maybe I'm on the wrong. Just listening to Pelosi, and I wanted to ask her a few questions. And so I don't think now I'm talking about the war. Maybe I can get in very good. I try so often, and I got in, so I stayed in here. I wanted to see if you could get. Could I ask you to get some other people on? This gentleman is fine too. Could I ask you to get someone else on?
Someone else on for what are you talking about?
Oh, you know, you call up and ask for people that have suggestions to get other people on your program.
Oh, that's for the next hour.
That's in the next hour. I'll
next call
hour.
Back.
I probably won't be able to get in. It's very hard to get into you, but thanks a lot.
Anyway. Okay, Miriam, we'll talk to you next hour. We'll put you through. Mike is next from Langlade County. Hi, Mike.
Yes, I have a statement. It is totally disingenuous for a Republican to tell us we got hit with $4 a gallon gasoline when, in fact, we owe $4 a gallon gasoline to the Bush administration and no one else for these reasons. And I don't dream these things up, staying up late at night. This is all reported in Portfolio Magazine. Number one, we know immediately in 2000, Cheney held an energy meeting with oil people. He refuses to let us know who was there and what was discussed. But subsequent to that, these things happened. Four American refineries were closed by big oil, reducing our refining capacity by 50%. Subsequent to that, oil companies stopped putting money into research and development and put it all in profits, where comes Exxon's $12 billion one-quarter profit. Subsequent to that, we invaded Iraq and created major unrest in the Persian Gulf. $4 a gallon gasoline can be laid at the foot of George Bush and Dick Cheney and no one else. The Indians and the Chinese have nothing to do with it.
David.
Well, a couple things. One, I don't necessarily disagree that the Bush-Cheney administration energy policy has been clearly lacking. The sort of lack of understanding where prices were going to go, understanding what supply was needed. Clearly, you know, what do we do in terms of alternative energy was clearly not effectively addressed. But having said that, part of what you're seeing, and again, I would disagree. I think in terms of looking at, I mean, China and India are about to become huge consumers of oil. And so overall, we're looking at energy demand worldwide increasing by 30% by 2030. Most of that, or a good portion of that, is actually going to come from China and India. That's obviously having an impact in terms of prices, given the fact that the supply of oil is not expanding by much, and that's where you get into this whole issue of drilling. How do you, in fact, expand the supply so prices don't go through the ceiling? Now, having said that, there had not been a push like you're seeing now from this administration earlier, and as a result, you're now seeing everybody sort of scramble in terms of trying to put together a policy at this point.
And thank you very much for the call. We have time for more phone calls and lines open for David Winston. The phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. David is president of the Winston Group, strategic planning and survey research firm. He was formerly the director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, where he oversaw initiatives, education, taxes, Social Security, healthcare, and technology. And he also has been a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, is a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call, and an election analyst for CBS. Lines are open for him. One line, 800-486-8655. And we'll return in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Winston, our guest, our phone number, 800-486-8655-227-2050, if you're joining us in the Milwaukee area. I want to ask a question, and I'm not sure what angle I need to take with this, David, but as I've said, I just got back from Ireland, which was incredibly expensive for American tourists. And I'm wondering how this, you know, the dollar doing so badly in many parts of the world, particularly in Europe, what does all of that mean? What does it mean for the campaign? What does it mean for the world? It's a whole different experience
of overseas. What you're seeing, because of obviously the dollar dropping in value has impacted a variety of different things. One, it is causing a lot of expenses here to go up as foreign products become more expensive. Part of that is also, given the amount of oil we import, that's also that's contributing to the higher gas prices as well. Short term, it's something to be sort of managed, but long term, if this doesn't change, it's a real significant problem in the sense of the overall wealth and value of what Americans have will decrease in terms of the rest of the world, and all those products go up in price, and it'll just be more expensive to live, as if people aren't already facing that already. And that's obviously one of the big challenges facing the next president in terms of what do you do to sort of reestablish the dollar. If I may, I want to go back to one other point in terms of your listeners that they maybe should look out for. At the end of September, the president just lifted his congressional ban, his ban on drilling. Congress also has a ban in place that expires the end of September. And one of the interesting moments that's going to happen, and this is one of the things that Pelosi is looking through in terms of how does she manage, is how the process will go to either reinstate or drop the congressional ban. If the congressional ban stops, then, in fact, things will be opened up for drilling. And so one of the dynamics that she's facing is how does she continue that ban? And just so everybody knows, that's supposed to end September 30th. So at some point in time at the end of September, this is all going to come back up in terms of around that particular issue and just in terms of your listeners, just to be looking out for that.
Yeah. And that ban has been around for some time, hasn't it, David?
Yeah. I want to say it was either 90. I want to say it was around 91, 92, 93, uh-huh. somewhere in that time frame. Or that may have been the presidential ban, and the congressional ban may have gone back into the 80s. But it's been around almost 20 years, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Tom from Burlington. Hi.
Welcome back from Ireland.
Thanks, Tom.
The one of the things, one aspect of the drilling, we don't have any, there are no offshore drilling equipment to even use it. The next thing is it's a different grade of oil in some places. But I'd like to point out one thing. During the Cold War, we had this policy of no strike first, and it kind of kept the international relations between countries in check. And then when we went into Iraq, we had we started this strike first policy, which made everybody uneasy on the world stage. And every time you have this saber rattling, when they start rattling the sabers, the price of oil would spike, and the price of oil above the price of finding, drilling, and delivering, this saber rattling price is added onto it. And if we could get the saber rattling price down, and guarantee that we're not going to have this strike first policy, we go back to the Cold War policy we had, we can immediately reduce the price of oil, which happened on July the 14th when it came out. So what are your ideas about? And there's one other idea here. If we have a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, a lot of times in American politics, they will put in a Republican president. So there's this election here. It's not a done deal. It's a very good possibility that Mr. McCain will be dealing with a majority held House and Senate. Those are just a couple of ideas.
All right, Tom. Thanks, David.
Well, the going back to the 80s, 70s, and 80s, and the conflict with the Soviet Union, that was based on, it wasn't anti-first strike. It was this concept of mutually assured destruction. The idea that if we'd launched, they could launch, and we'd just wipe each other out. It doesn't matter who launched first or second. We'd all just get wiped out. So that there were that policy sort of evolved over time. The first strike, and again, this is pretty controversial, obviously, was the idea that if you knew a country was going to take an action, can you take a preemptive action to manage that? There are obviously that becomes a lot more complicated in terms of, you know, what is a really definable threat. And so that item is clearly in controversy. Now, talking about the saber rattling, I mean, part of what you're seeing is when we as a country are not when we are dependent on other countries, particularly from unstable regions, it puts it at risk in terms of economically what those countries can do, and particularly given the fact that oil is so central to who we are, rightfully or wrongly, that's where we're at this point. It is very central to our economy. And so when in an unstable area, additional things that occur to make it even more unstable, there are economic consequences to that. So I don't disagree with him in the sense that a lot of this activity has perhaps created a much more unstable situation. The other element comes into it, then what's the price of national security? And then you go off into a whole other debate. So,
thanks, Tom, very much for your call. We go next to Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Your voice sounds very good. It must have been a good trip.
It was a good trip. Thanks, Frank.
Good. Excellent guest as well. I have a question for him, which is the Republican Party capable of seeing itself in its current position sufficiently that it might change to a one-nation conservatism? That is, you know, asking for good governance that addresses the entire population and the interests of the nation as a whole, rather than policies that pretty much have been responsible for the upward distribution of wealth in the United States. And the Republican Party is serving its base, as George Bush said, which means the ultra-rich. So I'm not trying to club the guest here, but is there a possibility that the Republican Party would radically shift its position towards a more national interest view? And so thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Actually, that is a remarkably good question. And let me start off by a little bit challenging what Speaker Pelosi said in her interview, but I think ending up sort of going in Frank's direction. It wasn't the Democrats won in 2006. It was Republicans got fired. And that's a harsh term, but that's exactly – people just got tired and fired Republicans. And so it wasn't necessarily the Democrats won this mandate. One of the reasons that Republicans got fired is this sense that we weren't we didn't care about people. We weren't focused on the middle class. And rightfully or wrongly, that was a very clear perception in the electorate. And so what Frank is saying, if Republicans are going to regain the majority, they're going to have to show that they care about the middle class, that they are focused on people. And that is probably going to end up defining sort of a clean break with the past here. So to answer Frank's question, if we're going to succeed, probably the direction that he just laid out.
And what's the possibility of success?
Well, McCain was certainly a different candidate for Republicans to nominate. I think of all the ones that you take a look, he would be the one that stands the best chance. He has been viewed as a maverick, been viewed as different. So as a result of that, he certainly has the potential for that. The thing for people to look at is how does he manage this relationship with the existing president of his party,
mm-hmm.
And how he goes forward. Now, I mean, there is one model that you've seen that has worked recently, and that was Sarkozy in France, where he was just pretty tough on Chirac and said, I'm going in a completely different direction. Here's what I'm going to do differently. And so the thing for folks to look for is how much separation does McCain make from Bush in order to be able to sort of overcome that negative perception that people have that the Republicans don't care about the middle class or people.
Mm-hmm. There was a story in the Journal Sentinel, Craig Gilbert, one of our guests yesterday, who was talking about whether he should be, which campaign would be more successful, criticism of Obama or a campaign that would separate himself from the president. Which do you think would be more effective?
And I have a huge bias here. This is not, people are not going to vote, people want to vote for somebody. You really need to answer the question, why me? And so ultimately, this is going to be about John McCain defining what he's going to do. And obviously in that, defining what he's going to do is going to create some distinction between Bush and potentially Obama. And so that's where he needs to go. It's almost like, you know, a triangulation between the three of them. He's not Bush and he's not Obama, and here's who he is. But ultimately, this is about who John McCain is. And that's why I have to say one of the things that is frustrating me at the moment in terms of listening to some of the ads that the campaign is running, it's the assumption if this race is that the race is all about Obama. If that's the case, and all it is Obama just simply has to show that he is capable of governing. If he reaches that threshold, then the election's over. What happened to John McCain? And I think one of the things that you saw happen to McCain the previous time when he ran into difficulty and ended up sort of having to withdraw from the race, but he had no money and ended up sort of having to go to just he and one other person traveling around the country, is it became about the campaign and not John McCain. And what makes me a little nervous right now is that may be happening at this point, that it's about the campaign and not John McCain. And ultimately, people want to vote for a person.
Yeah. Thanks, Frank, as always, for your astute comments. We go next to Lori from Cudahy. Hi, Lori.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. If we already have given permission for the oil companies to drill in some areas, why aren't they doing it? And secondly, if we give them further permission to drill offshore and we don't have enough refineries, what's going to happen to the oil?
Let me address the first one. They are actually drilling, but there's exploration. I mean, these 68 million acres don't necessarily all have oil underneath them, and so you have to go through this rather long process of doing geological studies to see what's underneath. And as a result of that, that just simply takes time. And so if you take a look at all those acres, they're at some form of that exploration. Some of them just simply don't have anything underneath. The argument that's made for expanding it is that there's another 600 million acres that have oil underneath, and if we were looking at all of it, then there'd be a better opportunity in terms of being able to get find reserves and get oil to the market faster. That's the basic the basic debate is, should we do the 68 million and leave it at that, or should we expand it to encompassing a larger area for companies to look at? The basic difference.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to John from Milwaukee, and we're getting close to the end
of the
show.
I'll make it as quick as I can. I want to ask about accountability. We've got a $9.6 trillion national debt. And if I'm not mistaken, over 80% of that national debt was accumulated under three presidents, President Reagan, President George H.W. Bush, and President George W. Bush. We've had three banking scandals in the last century, and those all occurred under Republican administrations. Now, who should I hold accountable for that 80% of the national debt and the three banking scandals that have happened in the last century and the accounting scandal?
In terms of the national debt, I am unhappy in terms of the rate in which George Bush has been spending. I think he could have been a little bit more fiscally responsible in terms of keeping a tighter tab on how much spending occurred. Scandals, Republicans have scandals, Democrats have scandals. Unfortunately, that's just sort of the nature of politics and the lack of accountability. We need to hold folks more accountable. And I think what you're seeing in this particular election is that what you're seeing from people is that they are, to a degree here, ready for a different sort of political discourse, and they are looking to elect people who, in fact, are going to sort of hold themselves to that higher standard.
Yeah. Well, you're a great guest, David. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll check in again.
Okay, pleasure.
Thanks. David Winston, our guest, and we also thank Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, for being with us for a good chunk of this hour as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Anderson for on-air production in Milwaukee. News ahead, we'll return with more Monday Conversation on the Ideas Network.